Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Welcome to DW's Africa Link program, live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. My name is Isaac Mugabe, your host.
And from the social media desk, I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
On the program today, at least 48 bodies belonging to an oil exploration team killed earlier this week in Nigeria by suspected Boko Haram militants have been found.
From recent happening, nobody is safe. Some people were kidnapped, some people were ambushed. Even University of Maiduguri is not safe now.
And are foreign investors a boon or a burden to Africa? That's the question we asked on social media. Your thoughts on the matter coming up later in the show.
That's right, indeed, Crispin. And Pakistan's Supreme Court disqualifies Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif from public office over long-running corruption allegations. These are some of the stories we've lined up for you. But first, here's a chance to listen to what's been happening around the world.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. Germany warned Friday that it would not accept U.S. sanctions against Russia that affect European companies, while Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel stressed the importance of applying economic pressure on Russia. He noted that the sanctions could also hurt companies involved in the construction of a new pipeline that would pump Russian gas directly to Germany. In response to the U.S. call for sanctions, Moscow ordered Washington to reduce the number of its diplomatic staff in Russia. A German court has paved the way for a diesel ban in the southwest city of Stuttgart, saying authorities have not improved the air quality in one of Germany's most polluted city centers. A spokeswoman for the Stuttgart Administrative Court said authorities must do more to cut down on nitrogen dioxide levels in the air.
Das Verwaltungsgericht Stuttgart hat die bisherigen Maßnahmen.
Stuttgart Administrative Court viewed previous measures by the state of Baden-Württemberg as insufficient and demanded quicker and more effective measures. An effective measure for the court is a blanket driving ban within Stuttgart's environmental zone, which must come into effect from January 1st, 2018, in order to respect the limit for nitrogen oxide.
Stickstoffdioxid einzuhalten.
Iraq's security officials said on Friday that up to 7,000 Islamic State militants still remain in Iraq even after the fall of Mosul. Though the northeastern Iraqi city was liberated last month, a UN refugee spokesperson says it is not the time for refugees to return home.
We do promote the return of the refugees, and we would facilitate it. As far as it stands now, these circumstances are not conducive yet for such returns.
This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. Libya's UN-backed government has denied striking an agreement with Rome to deploy Italian vessels in Libyan waters to combat human trafficking. In a statement, Libya's prime minister denied having asked Italy to send naval vessels into its territorial waters. Instead, he said Italy had been asked to provide logistical and technical support to the Libyan Coast Guard. Human traffickers have sent thousands of migrants to Italy by sea, with more than 2,000 people having died trying to cross the Mediterranean this year alone. More than 40 people were killed in an ambush by Boko Haram militants in northeast Nigeria, with many more deaths expected. The casualties include civilians and security forces, as well as at least four members of an oil exploration team, who say vast oil reserves could be found in the Lake Chad area, where Boko Haram remains active. The deadly ambush is a blow to the Nigerian government, as it claimed in recent weeks that the Boko Haram militant group was all but defeated. And in sports, Freiburg scored a lone goal against Slovenian cup holders Domžale last night, giving the Bundesliga squad a narrow win in the third round of Europa League football qualifying. Freiburg will play against the Slovenian side again at home next Thursday. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
Welcome once again to the program. My name is Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
We begin today's program in Nigeria, where 48 corpses belonging to an oil exploration team killed earlier this week by suspected Boko Haram militants have been found and taken to a hospital in Maiduguri, northern Nigeria. The corpses brought included 18 soldiers, but the military has put the toll at only 10 soldiers dead, and the government has since suspended oil prospecting in the area. Mohamed Alamin in Maiduguri reports.
There have been recent attacks on Maiduguri and southern parts of Borno State by suspected members of Boko Haram. The insurgents on Tuesday ambushed a team of geologists, which include staffs of Nigerian Petroleum Corporation, members of civilian joint task force, and military personnel, who were on an oil exploration exercise in Lake Chad Basin. Over 50 people were killed as a result of the attack in the Megumari area of Borno State, which is the Islamist militant's deadliest over the last 6 months. People in the affected area are losing confidence on the counterinsurgency in the region. Many of them claim that they are not safe as Boko Haram terrorists live few kilometers away from their community and the security are not ready to engage them despite knowing their presence. Williams Atta is a resident of Maiduguri, Borno State capital.
From recent happening, nobody is safe. Some people were kidnapped, some people were ambushed. Even University of Maiduguri is not safe now. Government needs to come out, put politics aside and face it squarely.
These incidents came after claim by Nigeria's defense headquarters that the recent attacks are mere effort at causing destruction, means to undermine the success story of the Nigerian army in the fight against Boko Haram. But people like Daniel Nyam Gwash, a resident of northeastern Nigeria, no longer trust any claim by the military or the government that Boko Haram is defeated.
Going by the full force of their reemergence, nobody tend to believe what the military have been preaching all this while. We have not seen any changes that rhymes with the claim of the military that they have subdued Boko Haram insurgents. Look at the killings all over the place.
Analysts like Umar Babakumu believe that Boko Haram is trying to show the world that it is still powerful.
Some of these attacks continued because they want to show the military that they can still operate despite the huge security beef-off and their strategies that were introduced. Nonetheless, these attacks continued. So people are becoming very apprehensive, that they are becoming so disturbed that despite the gains that were recorded in the past, these people are trying to revert to the situation we had faced earlier, which is very disturbing.
Mohammed Alamin in Maiduguri compiled that report. Crispin, what are people talking about Boko Haram?
Right. On Facebook, we asked, was President Buhari too quick to declare victory over Boko Haram? Stephen Ayin says, you can't defeat an ideology with bombs and guns, especially when that religious adversary sees death in pursuit of their cause as a reward to be desired. Use dialogue instead.
Obi Fever says, from political thugs to Boko Haram cannot be defeated because they made them.
And Jude Obinma says there has never been a time they defeated Boko Haram. Buhari government is full of lies and deception.
Crispy, now to a more related but positive note. 42 Chibok girls who managed to escape from Boko Haram when they were abducted from their school in 2014 have completed their college education and are waiting to join university. As Waisu Idris reports from Abuja, with support from a local NGO that supports girl child education, the girls defied all odds and are ready to cover up for the lost time and the captivity that they lost by the Islamist Boko Haram. Let's take a listen.
These are the voices of cheerful, happy 42 Chibok girls saying they were abducted by Boko Haram terrorists simply because they were seeking Western education. These girls are the few lucky ones who managed not only to escape, but also to have an opportunity to continue with their education up to this level. Dorcas Musa is among the few who jumped from the truck when they were taken to the bush by Boko Haram terrorists. She has great ambition.
We stayed for 3 years and we are thank God for them, for our provision, for their guidance, for their encourage for us. Now I feel better than that time that Boko Haram come and kidnap us. I want to become political science to help all the poor.
3 years on, they have graduated from secondary school with good results. But what interested the organization Girl Child Concerns to pick these Chibok girls and place them in different boarding secondary schools in Nigeria? Umma Ilyas Muhammad is the coordinator of Girl Child Concerns.
When girls are given the opportunity, they can excel to be something that you never believe they will be. So it's not about who they are, where they are, or where they are coming from. It's about giving them the support and showing them that they matter.
Overcoming the trauma these girls went through has been a big challenge, knowing that some of their colleagues are still in the hands of Boko Haram. Dr. Mary Mandara is the head of Girl Child Concerns and the country director, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
At the beginning, in the boarding school we took them, they had to double up security because they couldn't sleep. But now, look at them. They're all over the place. They told the governor emphatically that they all want to go to the university. The governor has promised to get them admission into University of Maiduguri for those that want to go to the university, those that want to go to School of Nursing, so they will go. But we've given them skills. The one thing that you'll be sure about would keep track of these girls for the rest of their lives.
It is clear that the girls have sent a strong message defying Boko Haram's plan to make Western education forbidden, which is still their major campaign in Nigeria.
Owaisu Idris with that report. Pakistan's Supreme Court has disqualified Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif from public office over long-running corruption allegations, a decision that ousts him from the premiership for the third time. The ruling saw political instability take hold in Pakistan once again, dissolving cabinet and leaving the country without a sitting prime minister. General elections are scheduled for next year, but Sharif now falls short of becoming the first premier to complete a full five-year term. For more on his trial, DW's Phil Gale spoke to Imtiaz Gul, a commentator on Pakistan from Islamabad.
He has fallen over a case that related to four flats that the family owns in London. So the court basically found him lacking on the evidence of the ownership of the flats, and he, according to the court, he also failed in satisfying the judges on the sources of income that he had shown. So basically, the entire story revolved around four flats, which the entire family denied in the beginning, and then it came up with different stories, which turned out to be partially true or untrue, and this is what provided the pretext for the judges now to disqualify him. And in fact, he was disqualified, and the court basically said that he ceased to be the prime minister with immediate effect. So he didn't really have to wait for the resignation.
Okay, so he has gone. I believe his cabinet has gone as well. So who's in charge now?
At the moment, there is no government following the Supreme Court decision, but right now his party is in consultations, and we are hearing that most probably his younger brother, Shahbaz Sharif, who has been the chief minister of the largest Punjab province, could probably be the next prime minister through a process which probably will require an interim period of about 3 months.
Imtiaz Gul, a commentator on Pakistan from Islamabad.
Now, Isaac, on our DW Africa page, we have an article on how foreign investment is a thorny issue in Zambia. So we asked you on social media, are foreign investors a boon or a burden to Africa? Let's begin with this WhatsApp audio message.
I'm from Nigeria. My name is Usman Noho Sunama. Honestly, the foreign investors are a burden to us in Africa. For instance, if you come to Nigeria, you will see a lot of things happening where the Chinese and the Indians, even the Lebanese, abuse the power given to them in this investing in the country. They need cheap labor. They don't pay workers. There's nothing like security.
Samuel from Ghana says, foreign investors in Africa here is a blessing rather than a burden. Creating jobs alone is a boom.
And JC Okuya from Uganda says, I don't think they're a burden, but they should be legally monitored as per the laws governing that country, because if left alone, they could cause a disgrace to the citizens.
Ashraf Athman from Tanzania says, foreign investors are a burden to African countries. They exploit our resources. They don't pay tax as per requirements. Also, large percent of them employ their own people.
So you see, Isaac, how divided people are on the
issue. Exactly.
Moses Mwangi from Kenya says foreign investors in Africa are just a burden because they don't have Africans' interest at heart, but they're just after enriching themselves and their home country.
And Christopher Muflam from there says, with regard to foreign investment in Africa, the Zambian case calls for a review of the country's regulations to ensure that all is safe. Anyway, keep them flowing, and we always read them whenever we can right here on Africa Link. And in case you've just joined us, you're listening to DW's Africa Link program. Live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany, my name is Isaac Mugabe.
And on the social media desk, I'm Crispin Mwakideo. Thank you for joining us.
In the next 15 minutes, with only a week to go to the Rwandan elections, people living with disabilities are upbeat that they will find no obstacles like before when they go to cast their ballot.
I have never voted because the polling stations around me were all located in hilly areas. This time, though, many things have changed.
And today is the Refugee Convention Day. For more on that and your reactions on social media, stay with me, Crispin Mwakideo.
That's right indeed. But let's go to this story. It's exactly 1 week to the presidential polls in Rwanda. And it is a very special period for people with disabilities because for the very first time, measures have been put in place to enable them to access polling stations and vote for a candidate of their choice. From Kigali, our correspondent Nasra Bishumba filed this report.
As presidential candidates go into their last leg of the campaign period, the National Electoral Commission and the National Council of Persons with Disabilities are putting final touches on facilities that will enable people with disabilities to vote. The president of the council, Emmanuel Ndayisaba, says that in the past, people with disabilities found it challenging to vote or even gave up on the exercise because they had to enter the booth with someone, normally a person between 14 and 16 years of age.
We have an agreement with the Electoral Commission where we decided that changes will be made immediately whenever our representatives, for instance, find a polling station that may inconvenience people with disabilities. We have also worked with the political parties and civil society to introduce interpreters for those with hearing and speaking issues during the campaign period. The biggest achievement, however, has been facilitating the visually impaired to vote. With their input, we came up with a system that will give those who can use Braille and those who can't have an opportunity to vote on their own for the very first time.
This is great news for many visually impaired persons, says William Safari, the head of the National Blind Sports Association.
Of course, these changes have made all of us very happy. I'm blind, and I'm one of the people who voiced our challenges when it comes to voting. We had a challenge where we couldn't vote in secret because someone else had to be with us in the booth. But now, we have a new system, and it is going to help us who we choose in secret.
34-year-old Marianne Mukamakombe uses a wheelchair. She is excited to be able to vote for the first time because her polling station has been relocated to a more accessible location.
I have never voted because the polling stations around me were all located in hilly areas. This time, though, many things have changed, and I am very excited because this is going to be my first time to cast my vote. Many things have changed for everyone with disabilities. This is new, but the change is great.
There are slightly over 500,000 people with disabilities in Rwanda. Despite strong political will and a robust legal framework, the National Union of Disabilities Organizations of Rwanda says that individuals with disabilities in Rwanda continue to be less educated, less likely to be employed, and more likely to be living in poverty than people without a disability.
Nasra Bishumba with that report on how people living with disabilities in Rwanda are ready for the upcoming elections come August the 4th.
Blog report. Now, she's a Nigerian television presenter, a talk show host, a model, a blogger, a trained lawyer, an occasional actress, and last but not least, a mother. I'm talking about Ariyike Akinbobola, one of Nigeria's biggest digital influencers. And earlier on, I caught up with her via Skype and asked her, how does she manage to juggle all these hats?
And I would say that I'm blessed with a fantastic team. I'm blessed with people who help me out when I'm not available to do certain things. I have 3 children. I cannot be with my children all the time. So I have people who help me out. The thing about being a mother and being a media personality is that you have to have people who are hands-on around you. Because there'll be times when you'll be filming for TV and you'll be filming till late at night.
Your vlog is mostly about relationships or lifestyle and issues like that. Why did you choose to focus on such topics?
For some reason, I realized that people like to talk to me. People meet me for the first time and they tell me their life history. They tell me things that they've never even told their best friends. And I just felt that with my vlog, it will be a way to connect with people. It will also be a way to share different stories about people so that people watching can also learn and realize that whatever it is that they're going through, they're not alone. So I tend to share real life stories and I also share my own experiences. Things that I've been through, I go on my blog, talk about it, and the response is always phenomenal.
Can you share with us one of your most memorable experiences as a blogger or vlogger?
I have many. So if I'm going to share a lot, I'm going to keep you here for like 2 hours. But one of the ones that really struck me and surprised me was a video that I did on my YouTube channel that I posted. And it's still on my channel, Arike Weekly. It's called Things Not to Do in Front of Your Man. And that's the video that I paid the least attention to. I had no script. I had nothing written down. I was just talking from the top of my head. And I was saying a lot of silly things. And that video has my highest views on YouTube. So watching it and looking at it and seeing that the thing that I paid the least attention to is actually the most watched. And the videos where I have to wrap my head, do my research and all of that, I go on and I see that I have 1,000 views or 900 views. And I'm like, okay.
You are one of Nigeria's digital influencers. What does that mean for you in terms of, let's say, being a role model for others?
Well, I will say this again, and it is something I always say. I am not trying to be anybody's role model. I just do me. And, you know, I just do the things that I feel I need to do. I've done things in the past that I've been judged for, and I've done things that I've been commended about. So I just do me. And if anybody wants to follow me, they follow. If anybody feels that I'm doing the right thing, good. I just do the things that I love to do. I enjoy myself and I make sure I communicate, which is very important as a digital influencer. I make sure I communicate. I make sure I engage people. I want people to talk. I want conversations to start from what I'm saying. So I do that and I'm able to achieve it. So if you're looking at me as a role model, I wish you all the best.
Nigerian media personality Arike Akinbobola.
I really found her interesting with that, you know. I mean, she juggles so many things into one and she's able to do that, isn't she?
That's right.
Anyway, it's now time to catch up on the latest of sports from the African continent. Here's Samson Omale.
All is now set for the Women's Volleyball African Zone 5 qualifiers for the World Championship, which begins this evening at the Kasarani Indoor Gymnasium in Nairobi, Kenya. Uganda, Rwanda, Egypt and host Kenya will play in a round-robin format. Rwanda women volleyball coach Jean-Marie Isinginyuva says no team should be underrated in the championships.
All the teams I think are equal now. Do you know that Egypt is a big team which play very technically, very cleverly?
Technical director of the Kenyan Volleyball Federation, David Lungau, is confident that the host will emerge winners against Uganda.
Uganda is a team that has really improved. Nowadays they play very good. So it's a team that we must approach with a lot of caution. But the way our girls are playing now, that will be very difficult for Uganda.
And now to some football news. 16 teams have been drawn into two groups following the draws of the inaugural edition of the 2017 West African Football Union Cup of Nations, WAFU Cup, which took place Thursday evening in Ghana. Host Ghana has been drawn in Group A alongside perennial rivals, the Super Eagles of Nigeria, the Gambia, Sierra Leone, Mali, Mauritania, Guinea and Guinea-Bissau. In Group B, Senegal, Liberia, Burkina Faso, Niger Republic, Ivory Coast, Togo, Benin Republic and Cape Verde will all slog it out in Group B. We stay with football as reactions have continued to trail some of the critical changes and decisions reached last week by the Confederation of African Football, CAF, in Rabat, Morocco, at the end of its three-day symposium. South Africa Football Association President Danny Jordan believes that South Africa stands a better chance to benefit more from the expansion of the number of teams billed to now take part in the African Cup of Nations, AFCON, alongside its revised dates.
For 2019, the AFCON that will now be having 24 teams, it means that in our group, we are top of the group together with Libya, that we're in a good space to qualify for AFCON as well.
For his part, the Confederation of African Football Vice President Kwesi Nyatake disagrees with the insinuations that the quality of the African Cup of Nations will drop following the expansion of the number of teams.
We're going to have 8 more teams coming on board, and nobody will tell me that that 8 will be made up of less quality or mediocre teams. I believe that apart from the 16, you can still find top-level 8 teams to qualify to the African Cup of Nations.
Our sports reporter from West Africa, Samson O'Malley, sent that report. Crispin, back to you.
Yeah, leaving sports behind. Today is a very important day, especially for the refugees. It is the Refugee Convention Day.
What's that all about?
Now, this legal document was originally drawn up to deal with the millions of European refugees at the end of the Second World War. Professor Maleha Malik specializes in UK, European and comparative discrimination law at King's College in London. And she explains what this law is all about very briefly.
What this commemoration of the convention reminds us of is the fact that it is possible to use the law, it is possible to use international standards to try and introduce some sort of humanity and compassion for those who have been forced without any fault of their own or because of anything that they've done, they've been forced to leave their homes.
And as Isaac, as you know, African countries have opened their doors to many refugees.
Exactly, Uganda, especially Uganda.
Angola, mm-hmm. Cameroon, Kenya. Mm-hmm. And but we ask the questions, are these refugees enjoying their rights under this law? Didace from Rwanda says, I know what to be a refugee means and how it is. I have been a refugee for 2 years in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The struggle I have experienced has become a stinging pain in my heart. So even though those countries have opened doors for refugees, they, refugees in brackets, may not be respected as it is required.
Well, Derek from Tanzania says refugees' rights are respected where he lives.
But Obiechina Peter from Nigeria disagrees and says no, their rights are not totally respected. Moving on to Gambia, we have a video out now on our Facebook page. The Gambian president did an exclusive interview with Deutsche Welle.
Yes, and Adama Barrow.
Adama Barrow. And he's calling on Gambians who are living in exile abroad to come back.
Yeah, to help with the reconstruction of the country.
Exactly. We have one comment here coming from Prince Bubaka Aminata Sankano, who says, for my part, I'm already returning to help build our new Gambian cinema industry, Cine Cambia. In September 2017, I'll be premiering my new Gambian films.
Bernardo Dodie says this is a president that believes in her citizens or in his citizens. In some African countries, diasporans are seen as threats.
And Susi says, yeah, we will. Generally, we Gambians don't like to live outside our country, but because unfortunately, God gave us a tyrant in these last decades, that is former president.
Yeah, Jammeh.
Exactly. And we were unable to live in the country peacefully. Additionally, we love and respect other foreigners living in our country.
Now, Crispin, you know, most of these topics, you know, attract, you know, the topic of Biafra. Definitely, there
must
be
right,
one.
That's
Harry
right.
Winter says, all Biafrans abroad want to go back home if only they have their republic.
Yeah, we always have Biafrans coming on our Facebook page and saying that they want their republic. Jambo Shipanga says, yes, home is home. That is where your roots are. That is where your dignity can be restored. And home is where one finds peace of mind.
Derek from Germany, right here, says, you do not need to call all Africans to come back home. They already want to go back home. But the decision to do so is often difficult because of lack of real policies and programs to back such calls.
I don't know about you, Isaac, but I kind of agree with that comment.
Yeah, sure, indeed, because we had a report recently of a lady who started a project, you know, that helps Cameroonians of return back home.
Exactly. Jonathan from Zambia says, the question is, are there jobs in that country? As a skilled worker, that is difficult if that country cannot employ a skilled worker.
And last but not least, Alex from Tanzania says, for the benefit of my country and my people, I can return no matter how difficult it is. Keep those comments flowing, and we will always appreciate to comment back whenever we can. And before we wind up this edition, a reminder of the top story. Once again, at least 48 bodies belonging to an exploration team of oil have been found in northern Nigeria. Now, on behalf of the entire production crew with me, the studios, led by the one and only Eunice Wanjiru, Eliane Gelducci, and of course our interns, Anna Sakios and Glory Mushinge, I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Crispin Wakideo.
Wishing you a splendid weekend ahead.